Is this going to end up being the last episode of Women's History Month?
I think so.
That's incredible. March has flown.
It's so funny. This happens every year. February feels like it takes forever. And then March goes by so quickly.
Absolutely.
I also think it's because, like, February, like, you can just, it's going to be cold. You know it. March has been a roller coaster of weather.
Well, it's so, I feel like spring as a season is just lying. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like, oh, it's going to be so beautiful and flowers and this, but it's freezing cold. Mm-hmm. There's dead leaves in everybody's flower beds. Yep. It's not pretty.
No.
So just go fuck yourself, spring.
That's how I feel.
That is how I feel.
Oh, God. Well, welcome to Herstory.
On the rocks!
This is a podcast where we talk about famous women in history.
We talk about good women and bad women and fictional women and non-fictional women from all times and places because women have nuance.
But keep in mind, we're drinking the entire time.
And we're not historians.
No.
We might dabble in history. I might even teach history to young, impressionable minds, but certainly not a historian. I don't, like, work at a museum or something.
Right, exactly. We Google, we watch YouTube videos, and we welcome anyone who knows more about a subject to educate us because we put this together in a week, and sometimes we just don't have access to the best sources. So if you are an expert on dogs and film, and you have anything to add to my story tonight, I would love to hear it.
And mine's part of the royals tonight, so everybody knows more about the British royal family. Like, even I love the British royal family, and it doesn't matter. I still don't know enough to be competitive.
God, what a week to delve into that, too, and there's all this Kate Middleton business.
Girl, she's gone.
She's gone!
Oh my gosh, she has disappeared.
The way of Diana. Except they're covering this one up way better. Anyways,
because Kate learned her lesson, she disappeared and she's not coming back ever since. Listen, I'm a conspiracy theorist on this one. She might have gotten surgery, but no way. Ever since the rumors of the cheating dropped, Kate has disappeared, and we haven't seen Rose either in public, either of them. So talk to me about
Rose, is
the woman that William supposedly cheated with.
Okay. Okay.
So
gotcha. They're
both missing. This is upsetting.
Well, this might be one of the things that we talk about in our Patreon.
Maybe
we'll get into that. Maybe we'll get into something else. You'll only find out if you join for as little as $1 a month.
Yeah.
Come and hang out with us.
I posted our story from last week, which we talked about what it would be like if our show was about boys. Who would we want to cover?
Yeah.
And Miss Krista just commented, please don't make your show about boys. And I was like, yeah, totally. I agree.
Oh, my gosh. Well, anyways, we know that you're busy. You are getting out all the coats you put away because you fell for fake spring.
Oh, my gosh.
Just like I did. And so you're doing that. Your phone is somewhere else, but you're still listening to us on maybe something else. And you want to know what these women look like. So we're going to do you a favor, a solid, and we're going to describe them for you. We're going to get a little physical. Allie, who are you doing and what does she look like?
Ooh, that was a struggle getting to that
one,
wasn't it? I am doing Marion Crawford, better known as Crawfy, and she's a slender woman from the United Kingdom with a long oval face, a slender neck, a smile with two front teeth that are a little bit protruding. They're not quite buck teeth, but it's just a little protruding. She has short, curly brown hair. She's traditionally seen wearing a 1940s style dress and a long, darkly colored peacoat over top of it. And she is most famously portrayed by Sarah Vickers on The Crown.
Ooh, exciting.
So that is who I am covering. Who are you doing? And what does that good little girl look like? What does she look like?
I am doing Lassie. Lassie is a female rough collie. She is a medium-sized dog with long fur. And her fur occurs in various colors, including light brown on her face and muzzle, with dark brown or black on her head, ears, and back sides and back legs, and white fur on her stomach, front legs, and neck. She has a signature white blaze, which is the space in between a dog's eyes going up and over its head. And she has the kindest, sweetest eyes that can portray sadness, fear, or anger if someone is threatening her person.
What a good girl.
She has a long nose. That's like the other, like, I think iconic thing. And pointy ears.
Yeah, she's so adorable.
Yeah, so that is Lassie.
Wonderful. Well, I want to know what I'm drinking for this iconic female dog.
Okay, so this is called My Pal Lassie, and we will understand why it is called that once we get into the story. Because it's not just like you couldn't call this My Friend Lassie. It has to be My Pal Lassie.
Got it.
So it is spiced rum, Aperol, lemon juice, fresh basil leaves, and honey all mixed together in a cocktail shaker. And then you pour it into a glass with ice and you top it with a bright citrus wheat beer. I chose Blue Moon, and then you garnish with lemon and fresh basil.
I love Blue Moon, and producer hates it.
What?
So I like never get it.
Shocking.
Isn't it?
Mmm.
Yeah, that's really nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he just doesn't like Hefeweizens in general, which is weird. I'm going to squeeze this lemon up in here.
Do it.
This is such a pretty color, such a pretty drink. The basil is like exploding out of the drink. So you can smell it like on the intake. Love it.
Yeah, I love a wheat beer. They're my favorite.
I like them so much too. But I make it like a treat to myself to get them. I got them recently just sitting in my fridge.
Nice.
Having a little fun.
Well, anyways, what do you know about Lassie?
You know what's funny? I wasn't really a Lassie kid, and it's not something that, like, my grandparents had on repeat a lot. I feel like people our age a lot of times would watch stuff like this at their grandparents' house. My grandparents watched a lot of, like, Gilligan's Island and, like, MASH, so I didn't watch this as much. I think sometimes I get the stories of Lassie and Old Yeller a little confused, which is weird. Like, did Lassie save a boy from a well? Lassie, go home, go save me.
The famous joke is, Timmy's in the well again.
Yeah, there you go, there you go. So Lassie in the well.
Yeah, because someone was like, oh, so sad, Lassie. And I was like, she's not Old Yeller. She did not get killed. And they go, oh, thank God.
Yeah, Old Yeller's the one that gets shot because he gets rabies, and that's a boy dog.
Yes.
But Lassie did save somebody from a well, right?
We'll talk about it.
No! That's in no way. That's not in my head. I know of Lassie. I know the basic idea of Lassie, but it's the way that I feel about Flipper. I'm like, okay.
You know that Flipper exists. And that's how I felt, too, because I didn't grow up watching Lassie. You know, I was a Homeward Bound girl, Air Bud.
Excuse me, why haven't we done Sassy?
Those are my celebrity dogs. Champ forever. And so.
Champ, oh my God. No, Shadow is king. Shadow is king.
But yeah, so I like, but like. Everyone knows the name and the dog Lassie.
Right.
You know, so it's like, but I was like, when I was watching the documentary on her, I was like, wow, I don't really know anything about this fucking dog.
That's how I'm feeling. I was like, I was thinking on the way home from school, I was like, maybe I should Google Lassie so I have a fact or two. And then I was like, no, I wouldn't do that about a woman.
Just let it like, wash over you.
Right. I'm just going to learn all about Lassie right now. Okay. Well,
let's do it. So my sources were a Hollywood documentary. It was like a Hollywood history documentary on Lassie and Wikipedia. There really wasn't much else. So let's get into it. Lassie is one of the most famous dogs in film history. Her heroism and loyalty is the stuff of legend. But who is Lassie really? And how did she manage to get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame? Most people start the story of Lassie in 1938, but there's actually been a heroic rough collie in fiction as far back as 1859. British writer Elizabeth Gaskell, so a woman, is credited with the first appearance of a Lassie.
Ooh.
Wrote a short story called The Half Brothers. And in this story, Lassie is described as a female collie with, quote, intelligent, apprehensive eyes. And she goes to rescue two half brothers who are lost and dying in the snow. When the younger brother can no longer carry on, elder brother Gregory, Lassie's master, ties a handkerchief around her neck and sends her home. Lassie arrives home and leads the search party to the boys. When they arrive, Gregory is dead, but his younger half-brother is saved. Now, this is the first fictional version of Lassie. But some say that there were a few real dogs that also inspired the character. According to writer Nigel Clark in The Shipwreck Guide to Dorset and South Devon, the original Lassie that inspired all the subsequent films and TV shows was a rough-haired crossbreed who saved the life of a sailor during World War I. Lassie the Half Collie was owned by the landlord of the Pilot Boat, which was a pub in the port of Lyme Regis. And on New Year's Day in 1915, the Royal Navy battleship Formidable was torpedoed by a German submarine off Start Point in South Devon. More than 500 men were killed in this attack. In a storm that followed the accident, a life raft containing bodies was blown along the coast to Lyme Regis. In helping to deal with the crisis, the Pilot Boat pub offered its cellar as a mortuary to keep the bodies so they could be identified. When the bodies had been laid out on the stone floor, Lassie found her way down amongst the bodies and she began to lick the face of one of the victims. His name was John Cowan. She stayed beside him for more than half an hour, nuzzling him and keeping him warm with her fur. And to everyone's astonishment, Cowan eventually stirred. He was taken to the hospital and went on to make a full recovery. He visited Lassie again when he returned to thank her for saving his life.
Okay, that's super cool. Animals are so awesome. And second, I thought Lassie was a border collie.
No, she is a rough collie. So border collies are black and white.
Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah, I don't know much about dogs. I wasn't raised with dogs. Mm-hmm. So the breeds are off to me. I guess I always assumed she was a border collie. But isn't it true that they, like, I don't know, I'm sure it's all in the training, but can't they collies be kind of snippy? Mm. Aren't they, like, herding dogs?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, because they need to have a job.
Right.
You know, collies are extremely smart, mm-hmm. and they're used as working dogs on farms.
Okay.
So they need to have a job. They need to be challenged. And when you have a dog that's, like, a famous type of dog, and then they get overbred and put into situations where it's, like, not ideal for them, and
right.
they're not being treated right, then, like, it can cause a real problem. And we'll also talk later on about what the popularity of Lassie did to the actual breed of the rough collie.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. Because they used to not be so snippy.
Yeah. Well, I also imagine that, like, working dogs, just this happens all the time, like, dogs that are bred to have, like, a really shrill bark because they have to be loud, then get in trouble for barking. And it's like, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. So, when the officers heard the story of Lassie and what she did to rescue the sailor, they told it again and again to anyone who would listen, and the legend of the brave collie was told all over the UK. Then there's the story of Bobby, the collie pup, who in 1923 got chased off by a pack of wild dogs while his family was visiting relatives in Indiana. They stayed there for a week looking for Bobby, and they couldn't find him. So they had to give up and drive home to Oregon. 6 months later, a very skinny Bobby showed up back home after walking 2,800 miles from Indiana to Portland, Oregon,
oh
to get back
God.
To his family. And this is a true story. And people, like, doubted whether or not, like, it was really Bobby, and, like, they proved, like, unmistakable. Like, people were, like, across the route were like, oh yeah, I saw that dog. Like, at this time, and, like, they mapped it out and, like, proved that it was the same fucking dog. The incredible story of Bobby traveled so quickly that the collie was soon a bona fide celebrity. It is said that as many as 100,000 people would line up at events just to pet the wonder dog. When Bobby died in 1927, he was buried in Portland, Oregon by the Oregon Humane Society, and it was quite a lavish affair. Rin Tin Tin, the dog star of 27 Hollywood movies, was there to lay a wreath at his funeral, which was officiated by the mayor of Portland.
Okay. I was hoping it wasn't officiated by another dog. I was like, do we have a pastor dog now? This is great.
And many people think that these are the stories that inspired author Eric Knight. So he was a British writer who first published Lassie Come Home as a short story in the Saturday Evening Post in 1938. The story about the heroic rough collie captured the hearts of everyone who read it, so he turned Lassie into a full-length novel in 1940. Set in Depression-era England, the novel depicts the lengthy journey of a rough collie to be reunited with her young Yorkshire master. And in this case, though, in the story, he is forced to sell her because he doesn't have any money. So this story just really touches people because it's like, it's so relatable. Like, you're in a rough spot, you sell your most precious item, your fucking dog, and the dog somehow finds its way back to you. You know, it's like, this is the thing that's like really connecting with people.
Hair for harmonica case, harmonica case for hair comb. I get it. I get it. It's so sad.
So everyone loves the story. And just a few years after that, in 1943, MGM turns the story into a movie starring Roddy McDowall and a young Elizabeth Taylor. This movie follows the plot of the book, showing the intense journey that Lassie goes through to get home to her family, traveling hundreds of miles from Scotland to England. This movie, like the book, was a critical and commercial success. And it came just at the right time. So, like I was saying, like, this is after World War II, when people were still trying to put their lives back together. And maybe they had lost their faith in man, but they could never lose their faith in a dog. MGM followed this with several additional films, including a sequel entitled Son of Lassie in 1945 and The Courage of Lassie in 1946. The Courage of Lassie sees one of Lassie's descendants, Bill, get conscripted into the army. And even though Bill is brave just like Lassie, it shows a dog going through PTSD. So this is a dog that is running messages through a battlefield. She is getting bombed at, you know, it's like really rough. And it shows Lassie then after the war being sensitive to loud noises and being afraid now of people. And she even attacks her previous owner, who is Elizabeth Taylor in this movie, at one point because she's so like feral, you know, which we obviously were afraid that we were going to experience with your dog, Mary, when she got lost for two months. Like they warned us that like she might not recognize you and she might act aggressively.
Right. She might be dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. So it just showed another creature going through what a lot of the men post-war were of like, I don't know why I'm reacting this way to people. I don't know why I'm treating people that I love differently. But like, you know, because this is at a time when they were still calling it shell shock. You know, no one was talking about the real mental anguish of war. And so to connect with this dog over it, like feeling the same way that they did, was like really helpful to people.
I'm sure it's like the feeling of like, I don't belong here anymore. Like I am like now too tainted for society. I feel like a lot of soldiers feel like they're, it's not just like the loud noises. There's so many other things of like the things I've done. I don't belong here.
Yeah. But just like Lassie, you know, there is hope that
poor Lassie.
Back to yourself. Then there was Challenge to Lassie in 1949 and many more movies until 1951. They made 7 Lassie films.
Oh my gosh. It's like a Land Before Time phenomenon.
And they also had the Lassie radio show, which aired for years, which I can't even imagine what that was. Because Lassie only barks. to be clear.
Somehow she made it on this show.
Lassie. Then on September 12th, 1954, the first episode of Lassie the TV show debuted. So this is the thing that I think really cemented Lassie in like the lexicon. So there are a couple different kind of phases of the show. So the first version of the show encompasses the first 3 seasons, and this is known as the Miller years. So during this first portion, we see Lassie living in a farm with the Miller family. So little boy Jeff, his single mother Ellen, and her father George, who is called Gramps by Jeff. So the first 3 seasons, she's Jeff's dog. And they're, you know, getting into trouble. She's rescuing everyone. You know, that's the normal shtick of the show throughout every season. It's just different people. Then in season 4, the Millers adopt a foster child named Timmy, and he is given Lassie to help him with the cope, you know, help him cope with the loss of his family. So then seasons 4 to 10 are the Martin years, a.k.a. the Timmy and Lassie years. So Timmy is adopted by the Martin family, and then they are the central all-American family at the center of this story. Fun fact, Cloris Leachman played Timmy's adoptive mom for the first, like, 3 or 4 episodes of season 4, and then she's like, oh, shit. I don't want to be stuck baking cookies for a dog for the next 7 years of my life. So she's like, I got to get out of here. So
sorry.
Just a couple of things. And she was replaced by June Lockhart. Seasons. And this is the famous, you know, Timmy stuck in the well.
Right.
So Timmy, I will say, is played by John Probus. And he is the cutest child. He is adorable.
So sweet.
He is so little in this show.
This must have been hell for the filmers. A small child and a dog. How many takes did every scene take? I hear it's the worst. Like, as an adult actor, to have to act with a dog and a child.
Well, we'll get into it. So seasons 11 to 16 were the Ranger years. So Timmy's adopted father, Paul Martin, got a job in Australia, and they couldn't take Lassie with them. So she was taken in by U.S. Forest Ranger Corey Stewart. These years are most notable because Lassie got to travel to national parks. She got to go to the Sequoia Forest
sure
and Monument
did.
Valley and all these cool places. And the show was now airing their episodes in color, so people were really getting to see the beauty of our national forests.
Cool.
And this gorgeous, gorgeous dog. So for season 17, the program shifted gears again and became essentially like an anthology series with Lassie traveling on her own. Getting into different adventures each week, meeting new people. Then for seasons 18 and 19, Lassie was taken in by Garth Holden, who was in charge of the Holden Ranch, a home for orphan boys, which he ran with his college-age son and his friend. This show, or this brought the show back to its roots by giving Lassie, you know, a ranch farm home base, which is where she settled in for the final 2 years of the series.
I can't believe Lassie has had more seasons than her story on the rocks.
Unbelievable.
That's crazy to me.
Lassie ran for 19 seasons.
Jesus.
Which makes it the longest running family network TV program to ever air.
That's crazy. Lass!
And for every one of those 19 seasons, from 1954 to 1973, Lassie was the number one show in its time slot, which was the coveted Sunday at 7 p.m.
No.
Number one show every year.
People love a dog.
They love dogs.
How many different dogs was it, though?
We'll get into it.
Oh, my God. I need to know.
So the number I saw for the Lassie show of the average number of viewers each week was 25 million. To put that into context,
nobody does that now.
No one does that now. Like, one of the most popular shows on network TV right now is Young Sheldon, and that only gets between 7 and 8 million viewers per week.
Yeah.
And that is seen as, like, a smash hit today.
Right, because we're all streaming things.
Yep, exactly.
We got other shit to do.
I mean, the final episode of Game of Thrones brought in a series record of 19.3 million. The series finale did not get as many viewers as Lassie on a random Sunday night.
Well, good, because the wrong person became king.
That's true.
Jaime Lannister should have pushed a little harder. No, he should have pushed a little harder. Kill that kid in the first season.
True.
Sorry, Game of Thrones spoilers.
Bran was one of those people that just kept popping up, and I was like, I forgot he was here. He's like the kid in the corner of the party that you're like, whoa. Why haven't you gone to bed yet?
That's exactly right. Let's get rid of him.
So, now Lassie wasn't quite done yet. In 1973, ABC created an animated Saturday morning animated program. Didn't need to say animated twice.
Nope, you did.
Called Lassie's Rescue Rangers. But this show did not turn out the way that they planned. There were a few negative responses to the 16 episodes of the first season, well, first and only season. Lassie's trainer, Rudd Weatherwax, said, "That's not Lassie, that's trash."
Because it was a cartoon? Really? That's so terrible. That's so terrible.
I love that quote. It's not Lassie, that's trash.
I don't think that, I don't think animated series get the respect they deserve. I think we need some more like adult animated series, not like funny ones like The Simpsons. Right. Like redo like a famous series or something.
Right.
All animated. That's trash.
That's trash. And other people agreed with him. The National Association of Broadcasters agreed. They said the manufacturers of this rubbish have incorporated violence, crime, and stupidity into what is probably the worst show for children of the season.
Oh my gosh.
People hated Lassie's Rescue Rangers.
Whoa.
Then there was the show The New Lassie, very original title, which ran from September 8th, 1989 to February 15th, 1992. This series centers on the McCulloughs, a middle-class family living in suburban Glen Ridge, California. The McCulloughs are the owners of the then present day descendant of Lassie. So to be clear, they're not pretending it's the same exact dog from 1954. And in another like weird thing, John Provost, who starred in the original Lassie series, comes back, but they're calling him Steve. And they're just like pretending that it's not him. But then he's like dramatically revealed that it is Timmy. Turns out he was never adopted. Darn paperwork issue. So he never went to Australia.
What?
But it's like, so did they just go and they just left Lassie and Timmy in the U.S.?
I guess he was just about and around. And then his dog had babies. And then that dog had babies. And now this family has... You know what? Tie it in however you want.
Who knows?
Make your own MCU, Lassie.
So now he's back in Lassie's. And in 2014, there was another animated series, and this one is still running, so I guess it's not trash. So now...
Paw Patrol!
It's Paw Patrol.
Surprise!
So now that we have an idea of how Lassie, like, just like the jerk, like, I just needed to get all of that out so you know... That Lassie has basically continuously been on television in one way or another from 1954
through present
today
through now.
Let's talk about the real life dog and the people who helped make Lassie an icon. So Pal is the first rough collie to portray Lassie, which is why the cocktail's called My Pal Lassie. Pal was actually originally supposed to be the stand-in for the first dog that they cast, but Pal was so perfect and such a good boy that they ended up using him. And I think I talk about that later, so why it's a boy dog instead of a girl dog.
Okay.
So Pal is the original Lassie in the first movie, and in a funny twist, he ended up playing... So he was Lassie for all the movies. So this is, like, he was everyone, but then, like, because the movies were aging forward, they couldn't just say it was the same dog. So then he would play, like, Laddie in the sequel, and he was playing his own son in the Lassieverse.
All right. You know what? Like, I don't think anybody really cared that much in 1950.
No. You could have literally said it was the same dog until now, and people would be like, fine.
Yeah, it's okay.
And then in the third movie, The Courage of Lassie, where Elizabeth Taylor was the... You know, what?
Did you, what kind of words did you write, Katie?
Okay. Got it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the third movie, The Courage of Lassie, where Elizabeth Taylor was not just a supporting role, but a co-star.
Wow.
With the dog. Pal played Bill, another descendant of Lassie. Pal was not only an expert at all of the stunts, like jumping over fences, swimming across rivers, wrestling a gun from a Nazi, but he looked at the actors with such love in his eyes that it really felt real.
With, would you say, puppy dog eyes?
Yes. In The Hills of Home in 1948, Pal even sneaks into his master's funeral procession and walks with such a reverence that, like, you really forget he's a fucking dog. Pal was also a very patient co-star. A lot of his scene mates were young kids, and many of them remember Pal as being a really supportive figure on set. He never got tired or grouchy, and he would just put his head on their lap, and they would take the scene again. So the dog was actually a one-take machine.
It was the kids. The
not
kids
so much.
Were the worst.
But it was nice because then, like, they had a built-in support system to the scene, so it actually made filming a lot quicker. Because the dog would be like, it's okay. Like, let's go again.
Hey, a man's best friend.
Okay. So Rudd Weatherwax, who we mentioned said this animated series was trash.
Sure.
Was Pal's trainer and owner. He became a legend in the film industry and even worked in other classics such as Old Yeller. So there is a connection there. And although Rudd worked with a lot of animals, Pal was special. And because the studio knew how valuable this one dog was, he even had his own limousine to take him to and from set. Pal was even pictured in a 1949 photo of the actors under contract at MGM. He is literally front and center in between Ava Gardner and Clark Gable.
Well.
And this makes sense because Lassie had helped MGM grossed $248 million throughout the 1940s.
Wowza.
Making Pal the fifth highest grossing star they had. And a lot of this is thanks to Rudd Weatherwax's training. So he didn't see Pal as just another dog who could do a series of tricks. He saw him as like his partner in the scene. And he trained Pal to listen to his voice and react accordingly, which is why Lassie could walk slowly into an emotional scene, act like he was afraid of water when he clearly wasn't, and lying down on a grave pretending to mourn the body underneath, even though really to the dog it's just a pile of dirt.
Right. Just like lay here and look sad. Yeah. Dogs don't know what sad is.
No, they don't. But the physical stunts were also pretty cool. Yeah. That this dog did. I saw footage of one take where Rudd has Lassie jump into a lake, grab the rope of a rowboat, tow it back to shore, jump back in the boat, grab a baby kitten that's in the boat, carry it to shore safely, all in one take.
Who?
I can't even get my puppy to lay down. We were trying for so long the other day, and she could not get it.
I quit training my dog. She just lives with us. She just lives in the house with us. There's no training involved.
I don't know how you do this.
I wasn't built for that.
No, me neither.
Consistency? No way! No way.
Another thing that made Rudd special was that he also always had it in his contract that Lassie would be scheduled to make a certain amount of appearances at hospitals to cheer people up. And some of these people are, of course, very sick kids. And Lassie did, you know, we say they don't know what sadness is, but, like, she did have an idea that, like, these, you know, like, dogs can sense things like that.
Oh, yeah.
And she could sense that some of these kids were dying. And, you know, she knew to be very gentle with them, and she knew, like, exactly what they needed. And, of course, like, I'm kind of going back and forth between, like, Pal and Lassie, because, like, to these kids, this is Lassie.
Right.
You know? And really, Pal answered to both, because right. he had been playing Lassie for so long, so, like, at this point, they were really interchangeable. Rudd was also a very vocal supporter of animal welfare and always made sure that all of the Lassies and any other animal on set were treated well and with respect. So if anyone has any fears that, like, the dogs were harmed or forced to do any of these stunts, like, from what I could tell, they really weren't. And, like, there were no, like, dark facts about Lassie. Like, the dogs were in pain. Like, they really never were in any. And as Pal got older, you know, there were other Lassies to do, like, the harder
the
stunts,
stunt work.
You know? Like, because there's literally one where, like, there's a burning house and there's no CGI. So, like, they literally set this house on fire. And Lassie is crawling up a lattice work to go into this house, like, breaking through the window. It's, and, like, again, the dog is really doing all of this.
And don't worry, people. MGM treated their women worse than this dog.
That is true and upsetting.
The message of the show. They're putting Shirley Temple on blocks of ice, but the dog, fine.
Limo, star treatment. Only lamb chops. So, now you might ask why a male dog was playing a female dog all these years. And apparently, it was just a real practical thing. Female rough collies shed their coats more in the summer. And it's really noticeable. So they couldn't film year-round with a female rough collie because they looked so different in the summertime.
People would be so confused.
They would be shocked. Meanwhile, switch the dog out for crawling up the lattice. It doesn't matter. Now, after they made the series of movies that we talked about, but before the TV show, they offered Rudd and Pal a retirement deal of $40,000. And they were like, and we're not going to make any more Lassie movies without you. But Rudd had a different idea. He said, all I want is the rights to the name Lassie. So they gave it to him.
Oh.
There are pictures of him and Pal signing the contract.
Oh, my gosh.
And this obviously worked out really well for Rudd and Pal because after the movies, of course, came 19 seasons
of a television
show. Pal did star in the pilot of the TV show. You have to start with the old reliable. But after Pal, they ended up using 8 Lassies over the course of the next 50 years. But they had to have a specific look because the original Lassie is technically not a perfect rough collie, according to the Kennel Club.
Oh, well, they can go eat it. I'm so tired of the Kennel Club.
Isn't that funny? Like, she would not be, like, allowed in a dog show. She's not the perfect version of a rough collie.
Boo!
She has a distinct, as we said in the physical, white blaze, which is the marking that goes from the nose and up between the eyes. And she has a white collar and white front legs. These are seen as defects.
Make somebody so cute.
And they're only carried through the male line. So all the lassies that were used were descendants of Pal.
Mm.
So they could get those distinct markings. But there's also more to it than just the markings. The dog had to meet the temperament of Lassie, you know, and Lassie ended up becoming a part of the casting team because, you know, you can only pair a good-tempered dog with a good-tempered kid, mm-hmm. you know, when you're casting child actors. So anyone who was going to work closely with her had to be approved by her. So they weren't just going to throw a kid in there and, like, be like, good luck, like, with the dog. I hope she likes you. So once she approved the child actor, they then had to develop a relationship. So sometimes, like, if it was a long-term character, like in the case of John Provost, who played Timmy, he went and lived on the ranch with Rudd and Lassie so they could develop that chemistry.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Over the years, of course, it became kind of a trope that every episode was the same. Oh, Timmy fell in the well again. Well, two things I want people to know are that Lassie helped out other characters too, not just Timmy, and he never fell in a well.
An old yellow thing?
Nope. This is just like a Mandela effect kind of thing. Like, people just say it all the time, like, oh, Timmy fell in the well. But there's only two instances of wells in the whole 19 seasons. One was in 1955 when Lassie pushed a mean oil executive into a well because he was mean to Jeff. So she was a murderer.
A real Jamie Lannister.
And then should have been Bran. And then in season 17, Lassie herself got stuck in a well.
So Timmy's going to get help. Yeah. No. Okay, so that's crazy. I was certain that there was a well involved.
Classic thing. And this is the great part. It is such a trope that John Provost, who played Timmy, jokingly named his memoir Timmy's in the Well.
That's really cute. I just, like, okay. In the 50s through the 70s, was this a problem? Is this a problem? Are people falling in wells? Because my best friend has a property with an open well that she has to, like, lock up because she has three little kids. I imagine this actually happened to a lot of people.
The main case is of baby Jessica. Have you heard of this? So baby Jessica.
The Ring? That happens in The Ring. It happens in Batman Begins. Come on. Okay, baby Jessica. I'm ready.
So baby Jessica was in, like, the 80s, though, and she fell in a well and got stuck in a way, and she was little, so, like, she couldn't get out, and she had, like, broken her arm and was, like, wedged in there, and it took, like, days to get her out, and, like, all these celebrities got involved, and it was, like, save baby Jessica, and
it's like the Chilean miners.
She became a celebrity.
Oh, my gosh.
It was, like, one of the biggest cases of the
early 80s. That's so fun. Like, I don't know. I didn't know this was such a problem that it's like a trope now.
Apparently.
Okay.
and I do want to also mention some of the comical, you know, unreal situations. Like, there was one scene where the mother, so Timmy's adoptive mom, gets caught in a bobcat trap. And when she gets caught because she's running after her tire while she's changing a tire on the side of the road.
Oh, and it's running.
Runs after the tire.
Oh.
And gets trapped in the bobcat trap. And then Lassie comes to rescue her. And she's like, Lassie, go get the C clamp that's in the kitchen drawer.
That's so specific.
And she goes, remember the one that the ranger showed us yesterday? And Lassie's like, yes, I do.
I remember that. I know exactly where that is.
And sure enough, she brings back the C clamp and... Mom's able to get out of the
bobcat
trap.
What is a bobcat trap? Is that like a bear trap?
It's yes, but with less spiky teeth.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. Because let me tell you, this woman was not in enough pain to be in a bobcat trap a la
bear trap.
Fox movie.
Oh, Fox and the Hound.
Yes, Fox and the Hound.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was another thing. I felt like like we're saying, like, wells were ubiquitous, so were bear traps. I feel like bear traps were in, like, every movie when I was a kid.
Sure.
I was terrified.
Like quicksand.
Them.
Terrifying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was like bear traps and quicksand are the two number one things I have to be on the lookout for as a young person.
Little did we know it's plastic.
It's the number one problem
facing the youth today. The rural youth. Also, I live in the middle of the city. Where are the bear traps that I'm talking
you'd
about?
You'd be surprised what we could find. If we turned Baltimore City upside down and shook it, can you imagine what would fall out? I bet at least some.
I will say, so apparently in the woods that Mary was lost in by our house, we do have a little stretch of woods that is way bigger when you're looking for a dog.
Yeah, crazy.
So someone got held up the other day. This person approached them and pointed a gun at them.
In the woods?
In the woods in Herring Run Park.
Oh, my God.
And said, take off all your clothes. It was a guy on guy. Crazy. And he was like, I'm not going to do that. And then he shot him.
No.
I know. The guy, everyone survived, but yeah, they haven't found him yet. Crazy.
Weird.
So anyways, Lassie also was able to tie a rope around a tree to help a stranded mountain climber up a mountain. And that was when she was a forest ranger. So
Free solo. That's how he got up.
It was all Lassie.
Didn't you know?
And maybe it's because a real dog is doing, like, the stunts. I don't know. But she does make you believe that it is really possible for a regular rough collie to save the day. And maybe this is why the rough collies became incredibly popular during Lassie's run. At the height of their popularity in 1979, there were 8,000 rough collie puppies registered in just the UK. But unfortunately, due to overbreeding and, of course, over inbreeding, collies started to have more negative traits show up in their line. And they were losing their sweet temperament, and it was being replaced with a very nervous temperament, just like we were saying earlier. So you have collies that are overbred, inbred, so they're not having their traditional characteristics, and they are usually going into homes where people don't understand what breed they're getting.
Right.
So it's a really bad situation. And according to, like, reports, it's meant that now people are scared to get the breed. So now the breed is dying out. Last year in the UK, only 500 rough collie puppies were registered. And they have officially put rough collies on the endangered breeds list. It's just, like, a weird problem, but this is also the issue with, you know, people overbreeding dogs to get, like, the perfect, you know, Frenchie or, like,
right,
whatever it is. Like, whatever type of dog it is. It's, like, I don't know. It's just, like, not healthy for the breed. It's not healthy for the individual dog, and this is the kind of shit that happens. So, anyways, that's my little PSA.
Thank you.
Dogs.
Save them. Save the dogs.
Exactly. So
buy a mixed breed.
And again, it's also, like, not that, like, these dogs that are getting bred, like, don't deserve loving homes too. But,
of course.
You know, I don't know. I don't know the answers to the situation, but it is a problem. So the original Lassie, Pal, passed away on June 18th, 1958 at the age of 18 years
That's an old dog.
He is said to have the most spectacular canine career in film history. And then his trainer, Red Weatherwax, passed away on February 25th, 1985 at the age of 77. But thankfully, the family business didn't end with him. His son, Robert, took over the Lassie training, supplying Lassies to the many Lassie-branded programs until 2004. Then Carol Riggins, who had been co-trainer with Robert, took over after him. She continues today as the official owner and trainer of Lassie with another Pal. Pal is the 10th generation direct descendant of the original Pal. And because of Pal and Rudd and everyone else who's involved in making this dog a legend, it's rare that when a rough collie goes out in public, you don't hear someone say, look,
it's Lassie.
And that's the story of Lassie and Timmy and Jeffy and all the kids she's saving all the time.
What a good little
bears
girl.
And bobcats. And
why do you think they made her a girl on the show?
I think, I don't know. I mean, I am personally more of a fan of girl dogs. you know, I don't know. I've had boy dogs too, but you know, the wiener gets in the way when you're petting their belly. It's not nice. Nobody likes that.
No.
You feel like a monster when like you graze it, and it's just I can't explain the feeling.
Do you think it's because they were putting her with like little boys? Maybe. Do you think it's like a cute relationship to be like, I'm a boy and this is my cute little girl dog?
Maybe. And it's also funny because some, it's like, I couldn't really make heads or tails of the Lassieverse because there's so many dogs.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because sometimes the dogs in the movies would be boys, mm-hmm. you know? So I truly don't know.
Hmm.
Like, but the Lassie in the TV show was always a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't know why. It's an interesting question, though.
Yeah. I mean, I was just curious because I love our little, I love when we do fictional characters and like how they're portrayed. And it's like, yeah. Lassie is such a good little, and most dogs in movies are boys. Shadow, Chance, mm-hmm. Old Yeller, you mm-hmm. know, Marley and Me, right? Marley's a boy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and maybe it's because, so there are a couple episodes that of the Lassie TV show that highlight the, again, bananas that like, there are episodes highlighting the power of choice when it comes to a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, when like Jeff in the first series gets Lassie, he's given Lassie by an old farmer and he brings Lassie home and Lassie like runs up the driveway and is gonna like go away. And he's like, oh, I guess she doesn't like me. And like, you know, he's like, how do I get her to stay? And the grandfather's like, well, you can't make her stay, son. She's a dog. She has freedom. She has rights. And I'm like, again, this is from MGM, who would like drug women all the time and like abuse them. Like, you're not giving any of these women choices. But the dog, yes. The dog has a choice.
Can you imagine somebody said that in a movie about a woman back in 1950?
I just got to let her go, son. But yes, yeah, so it's like that was a really big part of the storyline, which is very ironic to me. And maybe another major storyline was people who were afraid of dogs and Lassie being a good dog for them to get more comfortable around dogs, because it was like, you know, you have to let people who are afraid of dogs, you can't force them to like a dog and you can't force a dog to like a person.
Right.
That was like a really big theme in the show of like, everyone has their own feelings about things, so you have to respect them. And maybe having a female dog, like, the thing that you associate with like a natural aggression mm-hmm. isn't there as
right.
much.
Okay.
Know? I don't know. So that's another thing I was kind of floating around in my head of like, why is she a little lady?
Good job, little Lassie.
I know. Good girl.
I think we need another drink.
We do.
Oh man.
All right. We'll be right back.
Are back.
Part two, new giant cocktail.
I know. And like, okay, so it's not all alcohol, I swear. And this cup is like deceivingly large, I feel like. It's like a Pilsner glass.
Uh-huh.
And this is the first time we've used this cup.
Yeah, it is.
But mm-hmm. a brand new cuppage from mm-hmm. Aunt Terry. So there we go. Do you want to know what you're drinking?
I do.
This is called the Little Princess's Governess.
Mm.
And it is gin poured in the bottom of a glass. And then you put black raspberries in it. And then you top it with champagne, a little bit of Sprite. And it's supposed to be limeade, but I couldn't find limeade. So I just used lime. But I'm worried that's going to be a little too tart. But we'll see.
Okay, we'll see.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Mm. Champagne-y.
Mm-hmm. Champagne-y.
Can't really taste the gin.
Yeah, limey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kind of tastes exactly how I thought champagne mixed with Sprite.
Yeah, would taste. Drink it in college. It's perfect. A perfect drink.
I love it.
Okay. What do you know about Marion Crawford?
Okay. So she was Queen Elizabeth's governess uh-huh. when she was growing up. And then they were like super duper close. And then from what I understand, she wrote like a tell-all book. And I think the story is that like it really devastated Elizabeth, because she was like, this is a person I was close with. And now I feel very betrayed.
Right.
In a time when she was like I'm the fucking Queen of England. I was never supposed to be. And now this is happening. And I don't know why she did it. I don't know what was the situation. But yeah, but that's what I generally know about her.
Yeah, and I think that's the Marion Crawford or Crawfy, the take mm-hmm. on her and what happened and what she did. So I was really excited to do this research and learn a little bit of back information. And I got a lot of this from a one-hour documentary that you can find on YouTube called The Real Crawfy, The Story of Marion Crawford, the Queen's Governess. Mm-hmm. Obviously, also, Marion Crawford wrote a book. I read excerpts from the book, but not the entire book. And the mm-hmm. book is called The Little Princesses. Mm-hmm. So,
also, I want to say I love the name Marion.
It's good.
I think I love it because it was the name of the model in Funny Face, Marion. And also, it was my Aunt Teen's name.
Mm.
And everybody called her Teeny instead of Marion, which I thought was so cute. And I have a great Aunt Marion who I have her birdcage in my house because she was a spinster who just loved to collect cool things. And she was like the fun aunt. And
yeah.
I was like, that's
give me that birdcage. Thank you. Thank
you. A married spinster.
I would love to be a married old maid. Are you kidding? With a birdcage.
So anyways, that's just, I just wanted to shout out the name Marion.
Yeah.
I love it so
much. It's good. I've only, in my, all my years teaching, I've taught one child named Marion.
Really?
And I think she's going to go on to be president. She might be in like later high school now. She was like one of those kids that blew me away all the time. She's going to be something great.
Ugh. That's so good to hear.
Yeah.
God, like the rough collie, we need to bring back the Marion.
We need to bring back these kids that are doing something. It's like all the kids are good. I have so much fun. Just she's going to be something powerful.
Yeah.
Okay. Marion was born the daughter of a mechanical engineer's clerk on June 5th, 1909 in Scotland. But her life was quickly shattered around the age of two because her family had immigrated to New Zealand for her dad's work. But just 2 months after living there, her dad was killed in an industrial accident installing electric lines for the new tramways in New Zealand. So with the breadwinner of the family gone when she was just a tot, her family returned to Scotland and they lived like a frugal Presbyterian life is the way they described it.
Wow. The Lord of the Games. What?
Game.
Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings?
My God. Is built on...
On Marion's father's...
Marion Crawford's father.
Back. The back of that.
I was trying to think something like that and it just didn't work. But everybody knows what I'm talking about.
Sister wants to go to New Zealand on the Lord of the Rings tour.
That would be so cool.
I know. Mm-hmm. Especially since she's like really into it. Okay. So she's living this like frugal life in Scotland, but education was taken really seriously because she was a clever and diligent girl, and she knew it gave her a future escape from poverty to be really diligent. So she went to a teacher training college in Edinburgh where she was quiet and studious. She had no money, so she'd go straight home after work, didn't do any extracurriculars, didn't like stay on campus and hang out with the other intellectuals. But this is the 1920s and colleges were brimming with new science and psychology. And psychology/sociology a lot of times gets paired with teaching colleges because you're studying like kids' brains. Mm-hmm. So she's among the top students and is enthralled with her professors and plans on a career in child psychology, working with the poor children in the Edinburgh slums. So that's what she wants to do, poor children.
Okay.
Let's keep that in mind. So to pay her way through, though, she's a working class girl. It's 1932. She gets a temporary job with a grand aristocratic family near her home and decides that it's going to be a perfect summer job. Here, she would take care of the children who started calling her Cuppy because she would have like this cup of tea in the afternoon. But I assume a lot of people had a cup of tea. They had some.
Isn't that just like a normal thing in the UK?
Yeah, but I think there's the way they told the story is like, she'd be hanging out with the kids and come up and like rap on the window and they'd hand the cup out the window because she's with the kids.
Oh.
So they would like give her tea and she would stay out there with them.
That's cute.
So they start calling her Cuppy. Yeah. So having a 22-year-old governess in a house, like an aristocratic, staunchy house, brought new energy in. Mm-hmm. And it brought energy in for the kids. She's doing a great job all summer long. So she catches the eye of a visitor, of like a, like it's a family member to this aristocratic family, mm-hmm. who needed somebody to look after their two little girls on like a more long-term basis. Mm-hmm. She was so young and lively and was needed. So she just stood out among the old, like, the people who Mary Poppins was supposed not to be. You know, like, uh-huh. the governesses that are like, God, what is that damn movie? With the nanny. Yeah, Nanny McPhee, where it's like this young woman stands out as being fun and intelligent and, mm-hmm. you know, going to be good at her job. Mm-hmm. Of course, this happens to be the Duchess of York. She was like, okay, come on in. I can't deny it. You're too good. So Marion picks up and goes to the townhome in Piccadilly and starts to work with Elizabeth and Margaret.
Wow. So this is her second posting?
Yes.
That's crazy.
Yes. And she's there for a 1 year like trial period. And I also think that Marion is thinking eventually she's going to go back to the child psychology thing.
Yeah.
But after 1 year, they make this job permanent. Mm-hmm. And she's like full time living with the Duchess and Duke of York.
Mm-hmm. Well, and right now it probably seems very low stakes because it's like
so low stakes.
They're not going to be the princesses. So like, what is the big deal?
Elizabeth is so far out of the line of succession. You know what I mean? Like Edward is not even married.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Like, yeah. So like he's going to get married and have kids and whatever. Yeah. I think it's Edward the Seventh or, mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's going to get married and have kids and it's going to take, you know, Elizabeth. What is she? What would she have been? Third? If it's her uncle, her dad, and then her. But if he has kids, then they get bumped farther down. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's she's just, there's no way she's ever going to be queen. Super low stakes. And, you know, she put her plans and ambitions aside and adapted to this life where she would partake in the upbringing of the earnest Lilibet and the willful Margaret in a nursery surrounded with all of their favorite toys, especially the multiple dozens of toy horses that Elizabeth adored. And she would have her Crawfy pretend to be a horse and Elizabeth would ride her around. We only know that because of spilled secrets. Mm. Marion was so intimate with the family. She had lunch with them every day. She would call the Duke and Duchess by their first names. But she's also young and independent and was like, these girls don't need to be sheltered. So she would take them out on the town and on the underground. And nobody really knew what they looked like. There was only one time that somebody like stopped them and was like, those are the Duchesses. And she had to like get really curt and be like, get the fuck away from us. But, I mean, other than that, she's, like, going out and giving the girls money and being like, this is how you buy lunch. Because they didn't do stuff like that. They had never exchanged money, like, between hands.
That is so crucial, I think. Because uh-huh. what she's doing is she is seeing what they are. These girls who seem to have everything, she's pinpointing the things that they are actually lacking. And mm-hmm. she's like, what they're lacking is an awareness of the outside world. So, right. like, let's fucking fix that. And I love that.
And in her book, she has like these cute little moments where like they're about to step onto the underground for the first time. And like it's scary when you have to step over that gap and mm-hmm. like all the
mind the gap.
All the like it's loud and it's breezy because the trains are going. Mm-hmm. And it's just she's like, Margaret like even squeezed my hand as we went to like step in. And you know, Margaret is so like, it's me. Yeah. Get out of here, world. But
I'm the Duchess, it's me.
Exactly.
Fun fact, the man and the woman who do the mind the gap recordings
really?
For the London Tube are a married couple.
No way.
And the husband died. So Stop. Sometimes the wife rides the tube just so her husband can tell her, mind the gap.
Just to hear his voice? Oh my God.
Isn't that the saddest, most heartbreaking thing you've ever heard in your life?
I die about
it. Summer when you go.
I die about it. Sometimes, listen, I've never in my life, producer has never left me a voicemail, but
what?
I'm like, what if he calls me and leaves me a voicemail and then he dies and I listen to it all the time and then I lose my phone? I have that thought. He's never left me a voicemail.
You know what? I gasped at that. I've never left Casey a voicemail. What are we doing?
I'll text him.
If you call me, call me back.
Right. Like, you see my missed call. It's not a big deal. I need to, like, call and leave him a voicemail, like, just in case.
Make it something really stupid, though. Like, something you would never say.
Okay.
Like, hey, Jake, don't forget to get the organic eggs instead of the regular eggs.
That is something I would never say. So Marion's an educated woman, unlike me. And she was really great at her job at discipline. Like, she had the girls in line. She was a disciplinarian, but she was also their instructor. Part of her job was to educate them in reading and writing and arithmetic and just general manners, like how to be sociable while in the company of adults, specifically adult royals. But in 1936, Marion's life and a lot of the UK and the world would change its peaceful existence forever when King Edward VII abdicated the throne to marry an American divorcee, Wallis Simpson. I'd also like to say pretty much every woman in this show we've covered.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to say that would be another good episode to re-release because I don't know if a lot of people have heard our episode on that. And I think we did her with Divine.
Yeah, it was a great episode. Yeah, Wallis Simpson and Divine. That's a good one. Baltimore Babes. Mm-hmm. So that meant that Crawfee's employers are now the king and queen of England. Bananas. And the family picks up and moves to Buckingham Palace. They are now under constant scrutiny and cameras and the public. But they're still at this time is this distant private family mm-hmm. of the British royals. They have their own private personal lives. Mm-hmm. The public is becoming more and more interested in them, and especially the two little princesses. Because, again, Edward didn't have children. So this is very cool that now there's, like, this immediate heir to the throne that everybody can fawn over. It's like when JFK had kids in the White House.
Yes.
I should say when Jackie had kids in the White House, because JFK was a douchebag.
All he had were affairs in the White House.
Yes, exactly. Somebody else was raising his babies. Although he did really love his children. He doted on them a lot, but still. Hashtag Caroline Kennedy. Okay. The public is becoming more and more interested, and the family, the king and queen, go on this tour to America. The U.S. loves them as well. But that's kind of because the war is threatening in Europe. The royal family is revered as this perfect, loving family, and they are the symbol of the nation, you know, when everybody's in this fear and, like, London's being bombed. But Marion's role became even more vital because she had to take the royal children and evacuate to Windsor Castle and kind of just raise them there in the meantime. Now, they're a little bit older by the time World War II was rolling around, but it is still her job to watch after, oversee their education, make sure they're safe, and safe from the public eye while bombs are coming down on London. But she says, overall, we felt really safe. You know, the castle's a fortress, mm-hmm. and it was a pleasant time for us. Crawfee had in visiting tutors, Elizabeth and Margaret. They would teach them a little bit of French, a little bit of history, but mostly Princess Elizabeth. Margaret is not partaking in a lot of the history and stuff. And this is between the ages of 13 and 18 that the war is raging. And this took place in the rooms that are still known as the nursery unit in that area. Wow. Yeah. So, like, think about, like, Wendy turning into a teenager. Like, you were still mm-hmm. part of the nursery.
Yeah. That always confused me when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, aren't they just different rooms in the house? I was like, why is she flipping out about getting her own room?
Like, you are going to be fine, girl. You are, like, going to be fine. At this period in time, female education, especially in aristocracy, was not seen as necessary and actually seen as undesirable. Mm-hmm. And they called it blue stocking mm-hmm. if you had an education, mm-hmm. which meant you were an intellectual or literary woman, which, like, please call me a blue stocking any day. I wish. Elizabeth needed a little bit of French, like I said, a little bit of German, how to play piano, how to draw, how to be kind in public. The funny thing is, since the Middle Ages, the three longest lasting and most impactful leaders in Britain were all women.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth I, Victoria, and Elizabeth II, who were all highly intelligent women. But of them, Queen Elizabeth II had the least education, like the least formal education.
Really?
Yeah. Of those women.
That's really funny.
Yeah. And man, oh man, did the public fall in love with her during the war. Mm-hmm. She's in her mid to late teens. She's out getting filmed, driving ambulances, and, you know, doing all these promotional things to support people for the war. And people just love it. They are like, she is every bit a celebrity, but also absolutely silent. So then people are hungering mm-hmm. for information mm-hmm. behind the scenes in the palace. But the British royals have a standard in the castle. It's not possible to get in the inner circle and spill leaks. It's just the way it is. But the press wanted slash needed to know. So in 1947, Princess Elizabeth is headed to South Africa as a part of her royal duties, and she's photographed with a young, dashing Navy officer, Philip, and she wrote letters to Marion about wanting to get married and loving him and this and that and the other. And Marion wrote back about her love life. All this to say, they were very close. These are very sweet letters where they're just both excited to be young and in love. And, like, Marion is obviously, like, several years older than her, but still a young woman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Marion was fairly inexperienced because she had put off pursuing her own life to work in the palace. You can't really, like, move your husband in as well and be a governess. That's, like, not the way it works. Mm-hmm. But now she's very in love with a man named George. He had caught her eyes years before in her early 20s. But, oh, and he had asked her to marry him, and she said no initially. She wouldn't marry him, most people think, because of the job.
Yeah. But well, that's a job that is so all-encompassing.
You live with the family.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just, like, be a governess.
Just like, yeah, like you were just saying, move your husband into Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Be like, here's Uncle George.
Well, we have a children's home not far from here, mm-hmm. and a lot of the kids go to my kids' school, mm-hmm. And they'll talk about the, like, people who work there. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they're not married. Yeah. Somebody, like, on your own shift, you have to spend the night with these 30 kids in this children's home. It's like, that's the way it is. And then the next day you get them up, you get them to school, and then it's somebody else's shift. Like, it's just something I never had to think about. But yeah. mm-hmm. then when you think about somebody like Professor McGonagall or people Ugh. Who work in, like, the orphanages or children's mm-hmm. home, like, they're all in.
Yeah.
It is being a parent. You yeah. are raising a child. Mm-hmm. So that's what she's doing, because the children's actual guardians, adults, are preoccupied with World War II or whatever. So this guy was fun and athletic and liked music and dancing and tennis. And he played the organ at church. And he was a military man. And he was a bank manager. Now, he was a divorcee of 16 years. And also, like, I don't like this about him. He started talking to Marion when she was too young to get into the bars that he was going out to. Mm. And in England, you can drink kind of young.
I was going to say, that must have been, like, 18. So,
I'm a little uncomfortable with, like, the age gap, but I'm glad that she said no for so many years yeah. before mm-hmm. it became a thing. Mm-hmm. Often after the girls were older, around this age, Marion had asked the Queen Mother to be released from the palace duties. And every time the Queen Mother said, not yet, not yet, this is a bad time for us, it's a bad time for us, it's a bad time for us. So she had asked probably about on four different occasions. But eventually they do kind of let her leave, but it's only like upon Elizabeth's because
that's so upsetting.
You technically need a governess or like chaperone.
Oh, because you're a loose woman. Right. Or whatever the yeah. whole thing is. Like
whatever it is.
An unaccompanied woman.
Right. So what's going on is Marion actually gets married first before she gets released. Marion and George get married. It's a quiet affair. The palaces, like, they don't love George. They're kind of annoyed by him, actually, because mm-hmm. he's a banker, and he tried to get them to change their bank accounts from, like, one thing to another. Oh. And they're like, we're the palace.
Okay, Uncle George, step off. Like,
back away.
We're not going to change the entire royal family banking system just because you married Elizabeth's governess.
Right. So that's crazy. Insane. But then 2 months later, Elizabeth marries Philip at a, you know, a huge royal wedding, and it is the limelight of everything. So she gets released, and she's excited. Upon her retirement, she's given a Nottingham cottage on the grounds of Kensington Palace as a grace and like favor of the queen. The queen mother, Mary, gives them antique furniture with flower prints as a mark of her appreciation. So she's got this beautiful home with her new husband, George, on the grounds of Kensington Palace.
That's incredible.
It's very incredible. But her former pupil, while she is kind of fading out of the royals, Elizabeth is having new levels of fame. Mm. She went to America with Philip, and the two took the U.S. by storm. There's an overwhelming fascination with them and a lust for information, the way there was about Diana and about Kate and about Meghan. And it's bringing us to this era where the royals are seen as Hollywood movie stars in America. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, so much that when she's traveling around, the press is calling her Liz, like, on TV. It's like, you can't do that.
Okay, please use the formal ustad. That's a little disrespectful.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
That's insane. That is too casual for
Liz and her husband traveling around. I'm listening to the news, Katie. This is what they were saying.
I don't know,
news.
But I also guess I would call the current reigning king Chuck.
Yeah.
But that's
joke.
Because I don't really respect him. I respected Queen Elizabeth, though. I would never call her Liz.
No, but we'll just call her QE2 until we die. It's just an abbreviation for when we're typing. It's hard to type Queen Elizabeth II every single time. It's crazy. It's like WW2. QE2.
When I'm talking about the moment that I was with her on the street in Williamsburg, Virginia on my 8th grade trip.
Listen, girl. Shout out.
To the 100th anniversary. Not 100th. That would be crazy.
70th? It had to be around 500th? The 7th.
Of Jamestown?
Oh, of Jamestown. No. Yeah, probably.
500? That sounds right.
400.
300?
We're just saying numbers. We're just saying numbers. No, Jamestown had to be the 1400s, right?
Yeah. So in 2000.
That's 600. No way. Jamestown was the 1607.
There we go.
I had to get my brain wrapped around
that.
That
makes sense because it was 2007.
See, sometimes I really do have it up there. It's somewhere. I just had to like spiral through the Rolodex real quick. Here I didn't
go.
Google that, everyone. That
no,
was...
we she didn't.
No, I didn't. Okay.
We will die before we Google anything on this show.
Yeah, we never have. Not
we
10,
never will.
Not 10 minutes ago when we had to cut something out because we had to Google it. Okay.
You said...
Nope. Cut
not
out.
Gonna say it.
Forget it. Sorry. So the publishers then in America of Ladies Home Journal, which is like the best-selling women's magazine in America, want her story so badly. But they're running into the palace wall over and over again. And then someone in the Foreign Office is like, I have a good idea. You've been royals desperately searching for a scheme to improve cooperation with the U.S. and the British. Wouldn't it be perfect to get an insider story? So in a groundbreaking transatlantic unprecedented move, the American British press barons are given access to the palace. But they needed to appoint a writer who would win the confidence of the royal family so that it wasn't dry and boring when it was published and everybody would know who is speaking, had experience. They needed a source at the heart of the palace, but nobody in the royal family would do it. And nobody in the foreign press circuit knew the royals well enough to do it. So someone said, what about the governess? She was asked to write this story. She did not go hawk it around.
Okay.
Officially, the Queen Mother wanted articles published in the journal and gave it like a little green light as long as the code of family secrecy and silence is kind of like held.
Okay, we'll call it a soft green light.
A soft green light.
Okay.
So she's sending letters to Marian that sets off this dramatic chain of events. The Queen Mother said, I do feel most definitely that you should not write and sign articles about the children, as people in positions of confidence with us must be utterly oyster. If you, the moment you finished teaching Margaret, started writing about her and Lilibet, well, we should never feel confident in anyone again. But then also wrote to the man chosen to write the articles as the ghostwriters. To the man I saw the other day seemed to think that you could help him with his articles and get paid from America. This would be quite all right as long as your name did not come into it. Nevertheless, I do feel most strongly that you must resist the allure of American money and persistent editors and say no, no, no to offers of dollars for articles about something as private and precious as our family. So she's saying write it, but don't let people know you wrote it and don't get paid for it.
Okay.
This is a confusing set of letters. She said, I want you to do it, but I don't want you to get any recognition or money.
Well, it's frustrating, too, because it's also leaving all of the decisions on what to reveal and what not to, like, basically in Marion's hands.
Yeah.
If she were to come out and be like, hey, these are the exact parameters, instead of being all, like, cordial about it, if she'd mm-hmm. be like, these are the parameters we want you to stick in. Do you feel comfortable with that? That would be one thing.
Wow. Talking straight.
Talk straight to me. Like, right. That is so frustrating.
It's really upsetting.
To just be like, talk, but don't talk.
Yeah.
Be free, but don't be free. Like, you know, share, but don't share.
It's like, really confusing.
What are you telling me to do?
This is an abusive relationship. That's what that is really sounding like. It's like she's given some freedom, but not real freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So she's living in this cottage with her husband. She's kind of sidelined by the royals. She's being offered tons of money to write. She's probably being persuaded by her husband from this money to start writing. And she's like, okay, I'll do it. But once I'm done with drafts, I want to send them to the Queen Mother for approval. Mm-hmm. And in the contract, it says that at the beginning. But then later on in the contract, it also says that whether or not the Queen Mother approves, we're still going to publish it. So in 1949, Marion sits down, because this is going to start by being journals in Lady's Home Journal, like a column. But then in 1949, Marion sits down with a ghostwriter at a hotel opposite Kensington Palace. She doesn't think she's doing anything wrong.
Right.
And tells her life story to this ghostwriter. It's a popular novelist, Dorothy Black. And the transcript is handed to Lady Astor. She gets on a plane back to America. And it's given to the queen at the same time because they wanted no chance of the transcript being cloistered.
That's so messed up.
Yeah.
The illusion of doing everything by the book when you know you're, like, you're literally actively not doing that.
Everybody was playing Marion. The American publishers, the queen mother. And it's like she's the only one that got caught in the crossfires.
That's...
Her response that was the Queen Mother's response that was clearly in a fury because there's a ton of spelling and grammar mistakes is so mad about the book. She's like, we're never going to trust anyone again. I can't believe we trusted you. I can't believe you were part of our family. And Marion really knew something was wrong when for the first year of her life, she did not receive a Christmas card from the royals. Mm-hmm. This is the worst possible outcome for Marion. Her work was not able to win over the queen. They are outraged, and she can't even prevent it from being published. Ugh. George is irate, her husband. He's like, they can't get rid of us. They can't kick us out of this house. You know, the British and American publishers are making all the money because the books and columns are best sellers. And I need you to understand that she was not scandalizing them. There's no like the queen was in sexy lingerie and this, that, and the other. She talked a little bit about the king being moody, about Margaret's discipline problems, which we all already know, mm-hmm. about a couple of Elizabeth's teenage crushes, and about the queen's chilly nature towards Wallace Simpson. But it's just like normal stuff. Everything else is so complimentary. Even Americans were like, this is docile. I can't believe there actually isn't dirt. And like, she told the story as she saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is unprecedented. It broke the trust of the royals forever. And they are not a kiss and make up group of people. Marion gave out an authentic, unique, private record of the childhood of the soon to be queen. You know? And, you know, she talked about the queen's anxiousness at looking in the mirror and dealing with her hair and her clothes and how she acted in the schoolroom and her rebellion over the years. Like, a lot of things that we have in the crown, like ticks and things that the queen did, we only have because Marion published them. Like, we don't know about her personal life except for that we have them in this book by her governess. So in America, this greatly improves the perception of the British. They love it. And they have a television interviews with Crawfee. And she's so positive on the television interviews, saying what a great and charming child the Queen is, and about her great disposition and her studiousness and blah, blah, blah. BBC won't even air it because they say it's too provocative. Too provocative. Meanwhile, the castle is having tea with the publishers. But Marion is quietly being told to pack your bags and get out of the Kensington Palace cottage.
It's like she's the only one that actually suffers from this story being published.
Exactly.
That's so frustrating. Because ultimately, it sounds like it was a positive thing for Elizabeth.
A very positive image. Thing. Her image was greatly helped by this book.
That makes me sad.
Yeah. and to also, this is Queen Mary dealing with Crawfee. Mm-hmm. This is not Elizabeth's dealings. I'm sure Elizabeth's and Margaret's opinions are heavily influenced by their mother, of course. But like, this is the Queen Mother at this point. Mm-hmm. So she's out. They cut her off completely, even though at the same time there's this documentary about Elizabeth's life going on air in Canada, and like, everybody in Canada who is still technically in her tutelage fucking loves her from it. She becomes so humanized, and I guess like the royals just saw that as embarrassing. So I mean, Marion had one commodity, and at that point she's like, I sold it. I'm going to sell it. I got cut off. So she's got this regular column in the Ladies' Home Journal called, like, Crawfee's Column. And the books she's writing are getting thinner and thinner as her distance from the royals goes away. So then Ladies' Home Journal, like, realizes that we can just get this guy named Steve to write Crawfee's Column, and it can just be, like, basically about what's happening in Britain, and we throw in a couple royal names and it won't be a big deal. So now she's not even getting that money. But then there's an even worse thing where they're writing it, and this guy Steve, his name is actually Steve, is writing it in advance. And there is this, like, horse event the Queen is supposed to go to, and he writes about how, like, daring the Queen looks on her horse and this, that, and the other. But then the event got canceled. But they write it so far in advance that it, like, got printed anyway. And everybody found out that this whole thing is a big fraud. So many people got fired from the magazine. It's super stressful. People are, like, waiting outside of Marion's house with, like, cameras and TV cameras for, like, 6 weeks. But then it all dies down. People get fired.
As they do.
Yeah. Like, people gets fired from the magazine. Marion gets left alone. And because of it, her career as a writer comes to a screeching halt. A screeching halt. Many believe that she was deeply under the influence of her husband, George, whom she married after or during, like, the midst of her retirement from the palace. So he wanted her to capitalize on the royal connection. Marion and George had to settle into a moneyless, like, kind of meager retirement. They took the publication money that they made, and they, like, buy this cottage house that is, like, 200 yards from the road to Balmoral, and the royals, like, drive past it every time they go to their holiday, and they never visit her in all the freaking years. And you would think that, you know, Elizabeth and Margaret would mature and eventually throw away their mother's old hate. But they do not get over this. I mean, but this woman who raised them and taught them and spent probably more time with them than Mary did. They never forgive her. They never, like, send her letters, like, for breaching their confidence. They never, nothing. The woman who brought you up, not even a Christmas card. From that point forward, the palace employees had to sign a non-disclosure clause to protect their intimate secrecy. In terms of Marion, apparently her niece was, like, living with them or near them at some point, and George was taking advantage of another young girl, her husband. And Marion Crawfee, she like kind of denied it and then like just kind of sent her niece away quietly.
Oh my gosh.
Like George is like not a great guy. I want to be very clear on that. That
she probably feels so alone.
Well, she does. Because George dies in 1977 and Marion retreated further into her solidarity and sat with her little box of memories and letters and pictures from the two little princesses who she helped raise. She was really the first casualty of the love-hate relationship between the royals and the media, which we're seeing play out now. And she was naive and I think had a false sense of security that she was a family member and that they loved her. Then one day, a postman felt like something strange was going on with the house, so he called the police. And when the police came in, they found her in terrible shape because she had attempted an overdose. And there is a note by her side in her attempt to take her own life that said, "The world has passed me by, and I cannot bear those that I love to pass me by on the road." She did recover from this overdose attempt, but her health was failing, and she dies fairly shortly after in a nursing home on February 11th, 1988. Her funeral was not well attended. No representative from the palace was present, and nobody even sent a wreath. Marion Crawford worked with the princesses, raising them as a second mother and a teacher and a disciplinarian for 17 years. And she was seen as the family Judas, the first palace insider to take her privileged position to the press for profit, and she's marked at that time in history as the palace gossip. I mean, her story today has been recapped on a documentary in 2000 called The Nanny Who Couldn't Keep Mum, and then most recently in the drama series The Crown. And that is the story of Marion Crawford.
Really sad.
Isn't that terrible?
I hate that. I didn't know that that story was going to go the direction that it did.
I didn't either. I thought she willingly went and made a lot of money and lived happily ever after selling secrets.
Yeah. I thought it was kind of like, yeah, I'm not close with the girls anymore, but like whatever, because like my life turned out okay. Her life did not turn out okay at all.
And they like asked her to do it.
It's hard to picture like an entire life being ruined by outside, like, and it happens all the time, like I know that it does, but like, because like she came, like if she had existed 100 years earlier, even 50 years earlier, you're at a time like we talked about with Cassie Chadwick, where like you could move to another town, consume or like assume a new identity, and like nobody knew who the fuck you were.
Doesn't matter.
She is at the prime time for like something scandalous to happen, and you are not allowed to bounce back.
Yeah. And I mean, so many times in your life, like, imagine how many times she was like, "What if I had just turned down the job and went into child psychology?"
Yeah.
You know what I mean? One decision in her life where she thought she was making an amazing impact on the British Empire.
And because she did. Yes! I want to be like,
yes.
I want to make that clear. She did make an incredible impact on the British Empire. She made those girls more sympathetic to the outside world. She showed them how the real world worked. And even this thing that supposedly she was like so fucked up for doing actually helped people see them as real people. More than that stupid documentary film that they made, which we talked about in our QE2 episode. It's like, that was a misfire. This hit because it was real.
Yeah.
And it makes me sad that she goes down in history as a villain. Even I, in the beginning, was like, yeah, she's a monster.
It's what I thought.
This girl's trust.
It's what I thought going into the research.
And it's frustrating that so many people made money and, you know, like, you know, the magazines and whatever and the rags, and like so many people made money and were still fine. But her life was utterly ruined by this.
Destroyed.
Because, and they knew what they were doing.
Oh, they did. I think the Queen Mother She's a very interesting person.
We haven't done her yet, but we should.
We haven't. And we haven't done Margaret, but like the Queen Mother really, her like, she's old school queen mm-hmm. that lived in a new school world.
Yeah.
And I find her so very cool.
Yeah.
Like,
she's a very interesting figure.
Terrible, but well, very cool.
And she's very quiet. Like, you don't realize her influence until you get into stories like this. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, actually, she, even though she quite clearly from this story did not really raise her girls, she had a great influence over them.
Oh, yes.
So,
Interesting.
All fun.
I'm really excited to talk about this.
Me too. So now we need to talk about these two ladies in a little segment we like to call Just the Two of Us. Okay. So I figured if you put these two ladies together, you get Nana from Peter Pan,
which is so funny.
Because you
goodbye, Nana.
Bye, Nana. But it is like the reigning adult among children.
Right.
This dog, Lassie, who was literally helping child stars like cope on set, mm-hmm. and Marion Crawford, who is in charge of these two little princesses.
I also think what's so interesting about their stories is it both started with a book.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. then it became a movie/documentary. Mm-hmm. And then it became a television show. Yeah. Like, we have The Lassie Show and we have The Crown, which are like these iconic shows, and they both span this exact same period of time, right?
Yes.
Like, Elizabeth and Lassie are like growing up in conjunction with each other and then like die out at around the same time.
Yeah, they really are. And I also like that they both have roots in the UK.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I always thought of Lassie as very American. Mm-hmm. And then to find out that, like, no, this story is actually like very Scottish, British, like of the Isles. You know, I thought that was very interesting.
Well, you also talk about this collie pup who saves this life on this boat. And you said how the story traveled so quickly. People are so hungry for stories about royals that it is so dangerous. I mean, I showed you guys at the top of the show how crazy people are about it, myself included. And I know the repercussions. I know that a woman died because of it, and I still do it. Like,
I know.
It's crazy.
I know. And it's really sad, too, because it really shows, I think both of these stories showed, like, the tokenizing that happens when you grasp onto something cute.
Sure.
It's like these symbols, like a dog that saves kids from bears. These two little princesses become like symbols of the nation.
Mm.
And the fact of the matter is, it's like you can make Lassie into whatever you want to make Lassie into, because there are 8 Lassies. Like, Lassie is able to be curated because it's just the idea. Like, now you're talking about two little princesses that are real people, that have real emotions, that have specific identities. Like, they are real. And it's what happens when, like, you take this cute symbol too far.
Right.
It would be like if you actually broke apart, like, the theory of Lassie and, like, we're like, well, you know, like, it's not just one dog.
Right.
It's like, we know it's not one dog. That'd be crazy. But we do that to the royal family. We're like, well, you know, they have issues. It's like, well, yeah, of course
they're
they do.
People.
Like, they're people. Like, we don't give the same credit to people as we do to this fucking fictional dog.
Right. And also, I saw MGM as the royal family.
Yes.
It was like, you can make a choice. Like, MGM made a choice to give Pal's trainer the name Lassie and, like, let him run with it. Mm-hmm. And, like, yes, you've done us a service. We've made money. We're doing you a service. We have worked together. Mm-hmm. The royal family could have chosen to do that for Marion.
Yep.
And they didn't.
Yep. Well, and they appreciated Marion on the surface, but then when times got tough, they didn't. You know, I was thinking about how, yes, Lassie is riding around in a limo, like, doing all this cool stuff, getting a Hollywood, you know, a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, mm-hmm. and Marion is getting put up in this house and, like, all these, like, accolades on the outside. But then, like, when things get tough, like, they're ultimately damaged. The breed of collie, the rough collie, has been damaged irrevocably. Like, we now, because of, like, Lassie's popularity, like, we have damaged the rough collie breed. Like, we have bred out those things that made Lassie Lassie.
Right.
And Margaret's reputation could never come back. It's like when we spoil things so far that were originally so good and so good intentioned, you know? It's like people just wanted to hear a story of a good dog who loved her owners and came back and saved people, because it's like, you know what? The world fucking sucks, but dogs rarely do. It's really nice when, like, a dog is good because you believe it, you know?
I mean, what is a royal line but overbreeding, right?
Yes.
I like, it's so
the
very...
The fucking kennel club or the royal family? What is the difference?
And, like, I know it's so crazy, but it's, like, as soon as people get in touch with the outside world, they realize how crazy it is. Like, Edward, when he was with Wallace, he was like, oh, I don't want to do this. The same thing has happened to Harry with Meghan. He's like, yeah. I don't want to do this.
Yeah. Like, well, because you've been told your whole life that, like I was talking about, like, how Lassie is technically a defect.
Yeah.
Like, her characteristics, according to the Kennel Club of the UK, are a defect. And, like, that's what happens when you give these organizations, like the Royal Family and the Kennel Club, like, just this overarching, like, you're right. Why are they right?
Tell me why. Excuse me.
Tell me why you're fucking right. Like, just because, like, you've made up the rules. It just, like, I don't know. It seems so unfair. And it does kind of, like, it's weird that we paired these two, like, kind of just randomly.
Yeah.
But, like, I do feel like it shows a bigger problem when we put too much trust in institutions, because, like, also it's like I was thinking a lot about how, like, they're both seen as very solo figures, but they're really the product of a lot of people.
Right.
Lassie was not the only Lassie. Lassie had a trainer. Lassie had a lot of actors that she was working with. Like, there's a lot that goes into making the Lassie brand work. And There's a lot that goes into making the royal family brand work. And it's like we see Lassie and Marion as these individual figures, but it's like they're not. They don't exist in a vacuum. Mm-mm. Like, there's a lot of things going on. And, like, there are things that suffer when we just see it as one thing.
Absolutely.
I don't know. And when we give just one organization the overarching power to make the fucking rules. I'm really riled up now.
Listen,
about this dog and this governess.
We're blown away by this story. Some weeks we can't even think of something to say.
I really can't.
And here we are.
Between this woman and this dog, I got notes.
We're also both menstruating, so we might just be wild right now.
That's true.
Who knows? We're feral.
We are feral today. I was like, I'm going to cry this episode yesterday, because I was, like, doing my research. I was crying.
You did totally fine. You did totally fine.
And then today I was like, I don't give a shit about this dog.
Yeah.
That's the change.
I go through rip roars with my research. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
Okay.
All right. Well, I literally didn't even get to all my notes, but we have to toast.
Yeah. Well, let's do it. We're going to toast. We're going to toast.
All right. Who would you like to toast this evening?
I'm going to toast the scapegoats of the world. I just think that, like, that people take the fall, and Marion took the fall, and I don't think that we often look back or appreciate it, because it takes hindsight to see a scapegoat. Mm-hmm. So, to scapegoats.
Cheers.
Sorry, guys.
I'm going to toast to the dogs and the people who shape us and love us even when we are not our best selves. I just think that is so important, and I wish that Marion had that.
Yeah.
Someone who, like Marion made Marion led this, like, perfect life and made, like, one mistake that she was kind of bamboozled into making, and then it ruined her whole fucking life. And I just feel like Lassie would have loved Marion no matter what she did. And that is the difference between dogs and humans.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. Cheers.
All right. What are you enjoying in pop culture?
Okay, so producer and I have been watching that show on Netflix, Live to 100.
Oh, is this the one about all the bodybuilder guys?
No, it's about the people who literally, like...
Oh, no. Okay.
It's about the areas in the world called blue zones, where the average human has a higher chance of living to 100 years old.
Weird. Okay.
And this guy is going from place to place, and this guy's also, like, an insane biker. He, like, biked across 5 of the 7 continents or something like that. Like, he's a nut. Mm-hmm. But he's going to these places and, like, interviewing the people and sitting down and having meals with these people, which the number one thing, like, I like about this show is it gives, like, older people agency to talk about their lives. Mm-hmm. And they have so much to share. And I think so many times we just shove, like, the elderly aside and are just like, keep going, do whatever 100%. You're going to do. So I love that. But then he's actually, like, taking into account, like, looking at other people's research about what did they eat? What do they do for their daily activities? Why are they living so long? So it's just a really cool show that just makes you analyze your own life. And, like, one of the places is Okinawa in Japan. And, like, one of the things is that they're the elderly people are all, like, sitting on the floor to eat dinner. I mean, one of the many things. So it's like they're doing squats all day.
Yeah.
And then one of the areas was in Italy, and it's on this huge incline, like in San Francisco. So people are walking up and down hills. And it's just about this. We haven't seen a place in a cold weather environment yet. So I'm wondering if maybe it's got to be nice out because you could grow your own goddamn vegetables. But it's so far, it's just been really cool to see, like, there are so many factors. And he interviews this one old woman and she's just like, I don't get mad about stuff. I just don't let it happen. I'm like, fuck, I'm going to die tomorrow.
Yep. I'm angry all the time.
I live in a fury fit.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm angry a lot, and I know it is slowly killing me.
It's got to. So anyway, live to 100. It's super cool. Like, even if you don't want to live to 100, which I do not.
No, thank you.
No way. It's cool to watch.
82.
Yeah, I'm around there.
Sounds fine.
Yeah. We'll see how we'll see how modern medicine's doing.
Okay.
By then, I want to see what my knees are like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Well, if I'm in my 80s, like my aunt is, in her 80s and, like, going to the gym every day.
Yeah.
She's insane. She's so
fit and fun and happy.
And I think that's the other thing.
Activity.
These people that live to 100 are in places where, like, you can't just, like, sit in a barca lounger all day and, like, exist. Like, you have to walk up these hills and sit on the floor. Like, you have to be physically active. So, like, that's another thing that I think, like, gets very into the American mindset of, like, sedentarianism.
It's like, I'm retired. I'm done.
So I'm going to sit. And
it's like, no.
You need to stay active.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do some laps.
Go to the mall. Do some laps. I'm going to continue my series, which is now my new series this year, of promoting the books that you gave me for my birthday. I am in the midst of the Knock 'Em Out series by Lucy Bloom.
The names are crazy.
The names are insane, but I love it. All right, so they're just, like, fun romance books. But the first one, so you know the way that, like, you feel about Rhys Ann? That is the way that I feel about Knox Morgan.
Wow.
I know, and that's a real, like, I'm wow. so overtaken by this person in these books, and, like, and I know that it's unique because I did not feel the same way about his brother Nash in the second book.
That's funny. So you now have a fictional husband.
Yes.
Just like I have my fictional husband.
Yes, I do.
Good.
And yes, so I just, like, these books are fun. The way I was thinking about it was, I was like, this is like if a CW show was written down. Like a CW show from the early 2000s was
exactly.
written down.
Exactly. It's so cute.
It's just fun. And the names are crazy. There's a Waylay and a Waylon that live in the same house. Who wrote this? But I love it.
Lucy
did. And I love her for it. And, like, so I'm on the second book now. Still really liking it. But it's also hard because I fell in love with Knox in the first book.
And now you're dealing with Nash.
I'm dealing with Nash.
The straight edge.
I'll be dealing with Lucian again.
I know.
So anyways, but I just, like, I love it. So if you like this genre of book, go for it.
I just gave you books that I adore. I was just like, I know Katie will like these.
Yes.
I cannot.
And I do very much.
I have one of your other books, by the way. It's here.
Exciting.
It's the one that there was a substitute in the middle of the series, but I have it. It's ready to give to you.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you guys for hanging out with us. We hope you enjoyed this episode. I certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to hang out with us more, join us on our Patreon for as little as $1 a month. You can hang out with us. You can contribute to the cocktail fund. And you can learn a little bit more about our personal selves, who will soon be one day famous women in history.
One day.
Just kidding.
You mean today?
But today. And you can also rate and review us. That would be great. And follow us everywhere. Join us for Tipsy Tuesdays. It's always a riot. You can vote on who made which cocktail, which is very fun. And yeah, we love you. We hope you're having a great day and a great week and a warm spring. And we want you to never forget that well-behaved women.
Never forget to turn the lights off before, you know, going upstairs for bed.
Exactly. And they rarely make history.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Her Story on the Rocks. We are independently produced by 1986 Entertainment and proudly recorded in Baltimore, Maryland. If there's a woman in history you would like us to cover, you can email us at herstoryontherocks@gmail.com. You can also message us on Twitter or Instagram. We post all of our cocktail recipes on Tuesdays so that you can go get all the supplies you need and drink along with us. See you next week. Bye.